Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session. Pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The court this morning has two causes on its oral submission docket after settlements were completed, and they are as follows. The Star Telegram Incorporated, doing business as Fort Worth Star Telegram, and Betsy C. M. Tong, individually and as journalist for Star Telegram, Inc., doing business as Fort Worth Star Telegram, versus Jane Doe from Tarrant County, and Holland St. John, M.D., versus Marty Howard Pope and Sally Bates Pope from Travis County. In each of these causes, the court has allowed 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you wish to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear from petitioners in Star Telegram versus Doe.
May it please the court, Mr. John Williams to present argument of the petitioner. Petitioners are required 5 minutes to allow.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Williams. I'm counsel for petitioners, the Fort Worth Star Telegram and Betsy C. M. Tong. This is an invasion of privacy case brought by Jane Doe against the Fort Worth Star Telegram and Betsy Tong, as a result of two newspaper articles written by Betsy Tong and published in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram concerning an incident in which Jane Doe was raped. The trial court granted the petitioner's motion for summary judgment, rendering judgment that Jane Doe take nothing. The Court of Appeals for the Second District reversed and remanded, and we brought this application for writ of error. The issue that we see in this case is whether civil liability may be imposed on the press when it has published truthful information about a matter of legitimate public concern, which it has lawfully obtained either directly from the government itself or by resorting to commonly used, readily available reference works. The facts of this case as set forth in the summary judgment evidence are relatively straightforward. On September 24, 1989, Jane Doe was the victim of a rape in her home. She called the Fort Worth police, and as is customary, a police report was made out. An offense report is the term used in Fort Worth, as in most cities. A day or so later, Betsy Tong, who at the time was the police beat reporter for the Fort Worth Star Telegram, was at the police station, as she customarily did, making the rounds, so to speak. And a police officer named Sergeant Timmons told her about this case and told her in general about the fact that this particular case, this particular rape had occurred. After Sergeant Timmons told her about the case in general, Betsy Tong then went to the record section of the police department where she requested a copy of the offense report. And upon her request and payment of an appropriate fee, she was provided a copy of the offense report by the clerk in the police department. The offense report that the police department provided to Ms. Tong told her several things about this case. First, in the narrative section on the second page of the offense report that's in the record, it describes in a fairly considerable amount of detail the facts of this case. On the front page of the offense report that is in the record, certain information about Jane Doe, the victim, was disclosed to Betsy Tong. And it told her several things that later became relevant for purposes of this case. It told her Jane Doe's age. It told her the year and the model and the make and the color of Jane Doe's automobile, which of course her assailant had also stolen. And in fact, that was how he was ultimately apprehended when the car was spotted driving around in Oklahoma City. It referred to, there's a section on the offense report that lists the occupation of the complainant. It referred to Jane Doe's occupation simply as owner. And finally, it gave a business address for Jane Doe. Having that information in hand, Betsy Tong then went to a crisscross directory, which is a commonly used reference book available in any library, As you know, the purpose of a crisscross directory is, unlike a telephone book in which the listings are alphabetically by name, the listings in a crisscross are alphabetically by address, and the purpose is to look up a particular address and determine what is located at that address. So she went to a crisscross directory, determined that the nature of the business located at the address given in the police report was Jane Doe's business address, was a travel agency. And since Jane Doe had been identified in the police report as owner, that of course told her that Jane Doe owned a travel agency.
Counsel, do you say that it's part of your burden to show that this information was lawfully obtained? From your initial remarks, I gathered that you agree that's part of your burden.
Your Honor, I agree that on that ground, that was one of our grounds of our motion for summary judgment. And on that ground, as the movement in a motion for summary judgment, certainly it is our burden, at least at this stage.
And that's an element of invasion of privacy in Texas?
I think under the common law definition of invasion of privacy, however, the key issue in this case is whether the content of the information disclosed was newsworthy or of legitimate public concern.
Well, that's my point. Invasion of privacy is the sole basis upon which this judgment was rendered, as I understand. And do you contend that lawfully obtaining the information is an element of your burden of proof on summary judgment in a Texas invasion of privacy?
I understand, Your Honor. No, I do not contend that. I think the Court of Appeals made two errors by combining two separate grounds of our motion for summary judgment and confusing the two. I think the first error the Court of Appeals made was in finding that there was a fact issue as to whether Betsy Tong lawfully obtained the information. But I think the second error that the Court of Appeals made was when it said that because there is a fact issue on that element, there is necessarily a fact issue on the element of whether the information is of legitimate public concern. And I think that may have frankly been the more serious error of the Court of Appeals. The restatement definition of the tort of disclosure of embarrassing private facts says that the elements of the tort are that the defendant has publicly disclosed private information about the plaintiff, that information is highly offensive to reasonable persons of ordinary sensibilities, and that it not be of legitimate public concern. And I think a separate basis of our motion for summary judgment was that we negated, as a matter of law, that last element by showing that it was a matter of legitimate public concern, and that's not conditioned upon the manner of acquisition.
So do you contend that the lawfully obtaining or unlawfully obtaining the information is an element of the cause of action which you had the burden to negate, or is it immaterial?
No, I do not believe we had the burden to negate that under the traditional common law definition. I wouldn't call it immaterial either, because we brought forward a motion for summary judgment on two separate grounds, one of which is key to the method of acquisition, and as that issue was discussed in Florida Star in the United States Supreme Court. But secondly, on the basis that regardless of the manner of acquisition, if as a matter of law the information is of legitimate public concern, there can be no recovery and summary judgment would have been appropriate.
Did you meet the Florida Star factual basis on the lawfully obtained?
I believe we did, Your Honor.
Florida Star seemed to be undisputed that the information was in the press room available for anybody to pick up. In this case, does the reporter identify how she acquired the information other than saying she got it from the police department?
Yes, Your Honor, she does.
Who does she say she got the report from?
She says she got the report from a clerk in the appropriate records division of the police department.
And did she identify the clerk?
Not by name.
So how would a party wishing to respond be able to respond to an affidavit that does not identify the method of a clerk? It identifies a method, but simply by saying a person gives it to me. How does a person who wants to respond to that able to respond and say that didn't happen?
I think there are a couple of illustrations of what the respondent could have done if the facts supported it. She says in her deposition testimony what day this happened. So, for example, the personnel of the records division who worked at the Fort Worth Police Department on that particular day could come forward with an affidavit saying we never saw Betsy Tong that day. We don't even know who Betsy Tong is. We didn't give her a report. Another illustration.
Is that a reasonable? Is that a, when the newspaper had the information to provide to the other side, is that a reasonable burden to place on the other side? We can keep it a secret, and you have to go guess who to get the affidavit from.
Well, we didn't have the information. By the time the case was filed and by the time her deposition was taken, it, as I recall her deposition testimony, she said she didn't know. I'm not sure if she ever knew in the first place. It's, you know, a clerical position in a government office. You don't necessarily know the specific name of the person with whom you're dealing. But certainly by the time the case was filed, which was about 9 months after the incident, and then her deposition taken sometime later, she did not know. I don't think, though, that the identity of the specific person who gave her the report would be the only way that the non-movement could have negated that point. For example, there really does not seem to me to be a dispute that she got a report. That has never been challenged in any of the pleadings or the summary judgment evidence. There is perhaps a question as to what was on the report, which we also believe is unchallenged in Betsy Tong's testimony. But for example, the computer programmer of the police department could come forward with an affidavit that would say, our computers are programmed so that in sexual assault offenses, none of this information is ever disclosed in a report that's publicly available. This is summary judgment based on the affidavit of an interested party, no question about it. But this court has held that for purposes of Rule 166A, the question is whether the testimony is of a nature that could be controverted. Is it controvertible, and not necessarily controvertible in an easy fashion or a convenient fashion? And I think that her testimony is of a nature that if it were not truthful, it could be controverted at some point by the respondent.
How would you answer the concurring opinion in the Court of Appeals that there is a fact issue as to whether the details are newsworthy or of public concern?
I think that point, of course, was brought forth primarily by Justice Hicks in her concurring opinion, and I think that is a point which is perhaps most threatening to notions of free expression and free speech. In the cases that have analyzed this newsworthiness concept as a part of the restatement definition of the tort, generally speaking, the cases look to the broad subject matter of the story rather than focusing in detail on each particular fact that is set forth. Now, Jane Doe concedes that the general subject of crime is newsworthy, as she must. She concedes even that the general subject of this crime is newsworthy. And I think once that's established, it is impossible, consistent with the First Amendment and Article 1, Section 8 of the Texas Constitution, to get the judicial system into the role of being, in effect, an editor and trying to determine if each particular detail is newsworthy. I would especially commend to the court on this point four of the cases that we cite in our briefs. Probably the most forceful one is Ross versus Midwest Communications from the Fifth Circuit, where the court used the phrase that this would constitute judicial after-the-fact blue penciling. We also cited the Howard case from the Iowa Supreme Court, which is relied on heavily in Ross, and Anninson versus Donahue from the First Court of Appeals, which this court denied writ, and finally Gresbach versus Doubleday, which is relied on heavily in Anninson. All four of those cases address this question of whether a particular detail carved out of an admittedly newsworthy subject is the focus of the inquiry, and they say, and I think correctly so, that the courts must be exceptionally cautious in getting into this. That if the broad topic is newsworthy, some freedom is
got. Anything goes.
Well, at least if the details have some relationship to the admittedly newsworthy broad subject matter.
In Ross, though, isn't the language in Ross much more specific than that? Ross makes an issue about the details of the event being necessary to the story because of the similarities of the race involved. and therefore the blue penciling language goes to particular details not being similar, but paying attention to whether the overall details are. Whereas in this case, what is the significance of the fancy car, or the significance of the travel agency, or the significance of where the person lives in terms of the overall newsworthiness of the story that another crime's been committed in this town?
Well, to take each of those in that you suggested, Your Honor, significance of the fancy car is that's how the man was apprehended. He steals her car after the rape. He goes to Oklahoma City with some fellow parole violators, and he's found driving around in Oklahoma City and caught and actually brought back on an auto theft warrant. As far as the neighborhood, of course, it's only described as East Side. I don't really think there's an argument that that's too specific. But as far as the neighborhood is in general is concerned, there is no question that there is a legitimate public interest in knowing about incidents of crime in a person's own neighborhood. And the news story suggests that apparently her assailant had targeted her, if you will, because she shopped at a nearby convenience store. So I think that's highly relevant. The travel agency is the closest call. There's no question about that. But it seems to me there's a couple of observations. First of all, that fact was not in the first story. And they're suing us just as much for the first story as they are for the second. But more importantly, I think the question is not why did it have to be included, but having been included by the press, should the judicial system come in after the fact and impose liability?
One last question. I'm sorry, I realize your time's up. Should this court consider a difference under Article 1, Section 8, or even Amendment Number 1, between prior restraint and content of the article and damages after the article is written? Should there be a difference in our view of the significance of those provisions depending on whether or not this was brought before the article was run and whether or not the newspaper, having had the freedom to run the article, now must answer in damages for in damages the article causes, regardless of the truth of the article?
Well traditionally, courts have not been as strict in assessing damages, cases that involve damages after the fact as they are in prior restraints. That is correct. This court has made its views under prior restraints quite clear, including in the mandamus that arose out of this case, Star-Telegram versus Walker. So I don't think they are necessarily quite the same, Your Honor. I would, however, encourage the court to keep in mind that the fear of after-the-fact liability can be a pretty effective restraint. It doesn't come, perhaps, with the force of government, as a gag order does, but it's a self-restraint, but it can be quite effective. And the concern I have with the Court of Appeals opinion, and particularly Justice Hicks' concurring opinion, is if a journalist is writing a story about what is admittedly a newsworthy topic generally, the fear that, well, if I put in a detail that someone later on down the road might consider unnecessary, I'm exposed to considerable liability. It's a very effective restraint, I think, as a practical matter.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please report with the evidence
of the argument from respondents? Thank you. May I please report? Justice Cornyn, I do think that the burden was on the movement in this case to negate that the information is lawfully obtained. If I can take the court back to Billings versus Atkinson, you may recall that's the wiretap case, which this court in Kane versus Hearst just recently recognized or wrote about again and said that was where we first recognized the tort of invasion of privacy. Now that was intrusion into seclusion, and that was a wiretap. Mr. Billings was wiretapping the Atkinson home. Imagine that Mr. Billings not only wiretapped, but obtained private facts, and then on the information highway gave publicity to those facts. The restatement in 652A through I addresses just this issue and addresses the fact
that these torts are liable to be of combined factual nature. They can all factually give rise to several causes of action under invasion of privacy, except for false light after this court's decision in Kane. Now, that's what we say occurred under one of our theories, that this information was unlawfully obtained, so they did have the burden to negate that, Your Honor. Justice Enoch, I do not think they met their burden. I will review that more in detail in the argument, but at first, it had to be readily controvertible. Number two, it had to be clear, precise, without contradiction, and it had to be uncontroverted. And I will go ahead and go to that, take it out of order, as I had it ordered this morning in the hotel. Here's what Betsy Tong swears to in her affidavit. She says that she, after paying an appropriate fee, obtained it from the personnel of the Fort Worth, Texas Police Department. She says she reviewed it on September the 27th, 1989, but I disagree with Mr. Williams. She did not say that she obtained it on that day. So his example that we could have gone and found the record section person and narrowed the day down in response to this affidavit and gave controverting proof is wrong. But what did we get? Well, I think if the court will look, it will find the affidavit of Lieutenant Patton, who was in charge of the record section division of the Fort Worth Police Department. He stated he had personal knowledge of its procedures. He stated he was familiar with the policies and procedures of the record section. He stated it was their policy to protect the name, the home and business address, the home and business telephone numbers, and the vehicle identification numbers, and that that policy was followed. On top, only one objection was made to Lieutenant Patton's affidavit, and that was that it was lawfully released. The word lawfully, if you look at the final judgment, is stricken from his affidavit. But he states unequivocally that information was not released by the record section division. Mrs. Tong will not tell us what section, what clerk, what officer she picked this report up from. Sergeant Timmons testifies unequivocally that he gave notice to this reporter that this information was confidential, not to be released under the Open Records Act. He doesn't use those words, but you know from Industrial South Foundation versus Texas IAB decided in 1976, where this court recognized the tort, the right of privacy for non-disclosure of private facts, that information of a sexual nature is deemed confidential under section 1.01, 552.1101 of the Open Records Act. And if you'll look at the Open Records Act, that cannot be voluntarily disclosed. So this information for over the last 18 years, and when the facts of this case gave rise, for the last 13 years has been deemed confidential in this state. It has been litigated in this state. It has been protected in Morales versus Ellis. And this sergeant told this reporter, you can't have it. Now, based on those facts, I think we're entitled to get to a jury. And I think we're entitled to ask that jury, did she flinch this report? Did she bribe an officer? Did she do something crooked in order to get this report from the Fort Worth Police Department? Because I submit to you that this court should never condone the publicity of private facts when it's illegally obtained. To do so will be to condone wiretapping, breaking and entering, trespass. A reporter going to you falsely and saying, I'm with the government. I need your tax returns. This is not what the First Amendment is about. Extremism in the defense of a virtue is a vice in this case.
So if the affidavit had simply included the word lawfully, would your case be all over?
No, sir, I don't think so at all. I think at this point, if the affidavit, would we have won and prevailed if we'd filed a counter motion, Justice Doggett? No, sir, I think...
No.
Let me think if I can stab.
Let me rephrase the question. My question to you is, if you say the word lawfully obtained is not in the affidavit.
Lawfully is not.
Provided.
Yes, sir.
If it had been there, would you be out of this case? would your case be, would summary judgment have been properly entered?
No, sir.
Against you?
If the word lawfully had been there,
yes, sir,
it would not have been proper, because the testimony of Lieutenant Patton is still that he did not release the information. I think I'm missing the court's question, and I apologize. It may be just dense today on that issue. I don't think that, I think that whether a matter is lawfully obtained or not would probably be a fact question under most circumstances. What is a legitimate person?
Would that compel Ms. Tong to reveal her source?
We haven't reached that issue yet, Your Honor.
Well, if the police department says that it's confidential and our policies are that it shouldn't be released, and she says, well, I got it lawfully, isn't it going to be necessary in order for her to establish that who her source was? Is that a problem?
I don't think under these facts that gives rise to it. She testifies unequivocally that she got it from the personnel. The personnel testify unequivocally that they wouldn't have released it and did not release it. And so she testifies then, I don't remember who gave it to me. Now, jury, under the standard charge, is free to believe or disbelieve her testimony. And consequently, I think that's why we're entitled to go to a jury over that issue. Is the information of legitimate personal concern? Let me review for you the theories that the Star Telegram has taken with regard to this issue. At the trial, Mr. Williams writes that the facts are not common to every rape case. Every victim is different. Every crime victim is different. That can't be the legitimate personal concern, legitimate public concern. In the Court of Appeals, they argued that this was a general sociological issue, that the affluent are subject to crime. And yet the story, unlike Ross, was not about crime affecting the affluent. It was a simple crime report. You can only say that her age, the make and model of her car, her area of residence, the fact that she was on medication, the fact that she was the owner of a travel agency, is a legitimate public concern if you are prepared to adopt that the identity of every rape victim is a legitimate public concern. Because in a town like Fort Worth, which is a city with a small town mentality, this identified this woman. When she went to her pharmacist, when she went to her bank, when she went to her local civic clubs, when she went across the east side of Fort Worth, everyone in the east side of Fort Worth knew who the victim was, because there was only one owner of a travel agency with a black Jaguar.
Mr. Evans, are you overlooking the fact that she testified using her own name at the rape trial?
It may cut our damages, Judge Gonzalez. And she may testify, if we get to try this case, that she saw no reason not to use her own name, since the paper had already put her name or her identity out as far as she was concerned. But I would remind you, this citizen, that's post-article facts. And that should not operate to cut off her claim for damages, at least between the period, at a minimum, between the period of the article and the day that she voluntarily discloses it. I say it may be a factor that they can use on the fence, and I will say that to the court. I don't think it should cut off the damages, especially if we don't know under this record. And this court has been strong on remanding cases in the interest of justice for further development, that whether or not, under what compelled her to use her name at the trial. Now, that's not in the record.
Would you agree with the argument in the concurrence?
I do think it is a fact question, yes, ma'am.
The details as opposed to the newsworthiness of the event.
The rape was a newsworthy event. The details and the overall presentation of the article has got to be judged according to the restatements, and I think those who have written on it, as to whether or not they crossed over into the area of sensationalism in publicizing these facts. Whether it would be reasonably offensive, would it be offensive to a reasonable person? I want to remind the court, Justice Marshall, in Florida Star, points out and tells us that Restatement 652D, second, provides us with a sufficient standard for reviewing these invasion of privacy cases. You remember Florida Star. There were three grounds. Number one, whether it was lawfully obtained.
And in Florida Star, the name of the victim was in the story.
Yes, sir.
And it's not in this case.
That is correct. That is correct. But Justice Gonzalez, I can identify each member of this court by a fact in their life without using their name. Only one was a senator. Only one was an outstanding lawyer in Harris County. Two were outstanding lawyers in Dallas County. Only one attended Trinity. Only one went to Columbia. Only one served in Congress, is my belief.
Wrong.
I need to go back and review those. There's two, excuse me. I apologize.
Three served in the Senate.
The Texas Blue Book didn't do you justice, or my review was improper. Each of you has key facts which would identify you and which I could use to identify you and not ever use your name and disclose your private facts if I were to know them. And then I could give them publicity. That is true in a community like Fort Worth. I think it's true in many communities. And I think that's the importance of this tort, is it recognizes our right of privacy, which is developed under common law and developed under our Constitution. We have two great principles coming against each other here, our right to privacy and our right to freedom of speech. I see that I gather my light is off, or am I still, where's my time?
You've got more than 5 minutes.
Thank you, Justice.
You don't have to use
thought maybe I had gone through it. The Florida Star, to go back to the analysis of Florida Star. First, Justice Marshall writes that there were three key factors, and this is in the last two pages of the opinion. Was it illegally obtained? They placed great emphasis on that issue. Number two, the Florida Legislative Act prohibited the disclosure of the names of victims of sexual crime. But only restricted as to those persons that were in the mass media. Now, number one, our case is different because at least under one theory, we argue that it was illegally obtained. Number two, we're not going under a per se negligence statute which would condemn that behavior without any issue of scienter, would not consider whether or not she voluntarily disclosed it at a later date, or that it was known to the community at large just because it had happened. Those were the factors that Justice Marshall looked at, and Justice Marshall wrote, under 652D of the Restatement of Torts, you have a case-by-case analysis of whether or not these facts were reasonably offensible, or were offensible to
back
the
up to the, yes, sir. The legally obtained for just a second. Does it make any difference that that the victim in this case had not availed himself of the 5703 of the criminal code?
She did. I think that a further development in this case would show that, and I want you to put this in perspective, this woman is victimized, I believe, on the 24th. These articles are out by the 26th. She goes in and fills out her request for anonymity on the 26th. And she does not withdraw it until the criminal trial comes out.
Is the form available when she gives her police report?
Justice Spector, I can't answer that question from this record. But you've read the offense report. I don't think this woman was in condition to fill that form out. It is in the record.
But there's no... the way I read the statute, there's a special form.
That is correct.
I mean, is it a box that you check, or?
It is a form that you can go in and obtain and fill out to request anonymity, yes, ma'am. And I don't know the procedures that Fort Worth Police Department followed.
You don't know
in 1989.
The officer has that available when he
I do not know, and I don't believe that that's developed under this record at this time. Now, I do want to point out one thing. We have not sued for a violation of that criminal code procedure. and we have not attempted to make this a negligence per se case. Because of the vices that the Supreme Court of the United States pointed out with regard to the statute in Florida, we think the common law gives us greater protection than any statutory authority in this state, because the common law protects us from that publication. The has not been addressed. There's an issue presented that this matter was not adequately briefed. This court has had a liberal policy, and the Court of Appeals has had a liberal policy for many years construing briefs to promote the interest of justice. I would just simply say to the court that our point of error said that this defense, the defense didn't apply. It is there. We addressed it, and we cited cases for the proposition that the tort is recognized. Now, I've been wanting to use the term sine qua non in this argument ever since reading it in Cain versus Hurst, and I've looked it up twice and tried to learn how to say it. But falsity is a sine qua non of defamation. Truth is a sine qua non of this tort. Justice Brandeis, in his article in the Harvard Law Review, wrote that truth is not a defense to this tort. That site is Harvard Law Review, Volume 4, Number 5, page 218, where he wrote, "The truth of the matter published does not afford a defense. Obviously, this branch of law should have no concern with the truth or falsehood of the matters published." I appreciate your time, and I think I have some time, and if there are any further questions, I, of course, will answer those questions at this time.
Anything further? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to turn to the issue raised by Justice Cornyn concerning our burden to negate this element of lawfully obtained, and I gave the court my views on whether it was our burden, but I want to say now that if it is our burden, we met it. And I think understanding that issue requires a careful comparison of Betsy Tong's testimony, both in her affidavit and in her deposition, with Sergeant Timmons' affidavit. And I would especially refer the court to that portion of Betsy Tong's deposition, which is in the record at page 105 of the transcript. But at that passage of her deposition, she was asked by Jane Doe's counsel, "When did you first see this report?" And she answers, "I first saw this after Sergeant Timmons told me about it, and I went to the clerk's office." "When you first talked to Sergeant Timmons, did you have this report in your possession?" "No." "It's your testimony you obtained this report after talking to Mr. Timmons, is that correct?" "Yes." And then skipping down a couple of questions, he's asked, "Do you recall the date?" And she answers, "It would have been September 27, 1989. Now, that's from her deposition. It's not in her affidavit, but I think it is clear what she is saying, and that could have been controverted in the manner I suggested in the opening remarks.
I'm trying to get the sequence of events down here. If the incident occurred on the 24th and the story came out on the 26th, she didn't obtain that until the 27th, approximately.
Your Honor,
the counsel says he misspoke himself. So.
I may double check the dates on the stories. The first story, Your Honor, and I think perhaps this will clarify. Star Telegram is one of the few remaining papers with a separate afternoon and morning edition. The first story, the one where the headline is "Rape Suspected Arrested in Oklahoma Driving Victim's Car," ran in the afternoon edition on the 27th. And I think it may not be in the portion that's in the record, but I think her testimony was that she had gone to the police station early that morning. And then the second story is the following morning edition, September 28th.
With regards to the element of truth lawfully obtained, why does not Sergeant Timmons' affidavit controvert that it was lawfully obtained?
I think there are a couple of reasons, Justice Gonzalez. First of all, he really doesn't contradict Ms. Tong's testimony. If you look at Sergeant Timmons' affidavit carefully, what he says is that he did not provide Betsy with identifying information, a term which he does not define. He doesn't deny that he talked to her about the case in general, and he certainly doesn't deny that she later went and obtained a police report. He says that he told her releasing this information was against police department policy. Well, that certainly doesn't contradict whether it happened or not. It doesn't even contradict what the policies are. All he's saying is that's what he told her. And then finally, he says, to the best of my knowledge, this practice was followed by myself and other members of the police department sexual assault division. I think there's two key phrases in that portion of his testimony. One, that to the best of my knowledge, and we cited some of the cases that talk about the inadequacy of affidavits that contain that kind of language. And secondly, he is limiting his testimony only to that particular division, the sexual assault division. What she says as far as how she obtained the specific information that is now at issue is from the police report. And so I don't think he contradicts it factually. More importantly, though, nobody has suggested she did anything illegal. And Mr. Evans says he wants to go to a jury to see if she bribed somebody or stole the report or something of that nature. That has never been alleged or in any of their pleadings or even a hint of that brought forward in any of the summary judgment evidence. Their whole theme in this case from day one on this point has been that because the information is not public under the Open Records Act, that made it unlawful for Betsy Tong to obtain it, and that is simply not the law. Florida Star had the same facts, and the Supreme Court rejected it.
What about the Open Records Act provision you just mentioned?
The 5702 and 5703 provision, Your Honor? I think that is relevant that she did not fill out that form at the time of the article. And I would refer the court to a couple of passages in the record. The form was filled out by Jane Doe on October 3rd, 1989, after the articles. The form itself is in the record at page 91, and Justice Specter, it is a preprinted
form. I'm talking about the non-disclosure provision of the Open Records Act, which opposing counsel mentioned.
I beg your honor. Beg your pardon, Justice Gamage. The fact that under the Open Records Act, it is not public means that government cannot be compelled to disclose it upon request. But what Florida Star said quite clearly is that does not make it unlawful for the recipient to take the information and do with it as he or she sees fit. And I think it would impose a terrible burden on the press or citizens if a citizen coming to government asking for information, being provided the information, then has the burden to sift through it and try to determine, well, did they give me more than they should have? Did they give me something that really wasn't public? What should I do about it? If there's a remedy necessary, the remedy ought to lie against government itself, which wrongfully puts out the information. Of course, by analogy, 5703 has that remedy. If a law enforcement official wrongfully discloses information after the victim has elected the pseudonym, it's a Class C misdemeanor. That's where the remedy should lie if it's necessary.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will now take a brief recess.